Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for September 16th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valley and State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Arizona Officials Mix Grief and Political Fire at Kirk Vigil, written by Laura Grissoni. Grief, anger, and calls for political retribution were in the air as prominent figures from Arizona and across the nation gathered in the nation's capital for a prayer vigil in memory of Charlie Kirk. Kirk, the conservative activist, was shot and killed September 10th at a college campus in Utah. The September 14th evening vigil was held in a packed concert hall at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson spoke in soothing tones, telling the crowd, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. Charlie Kirk did so much in his short life," said Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. "He spurred that on in other people." Carrie Lake, the unsuccessful Republican candidate for Arizona governor and senator, now serving as a senior advisor to the United States' global media agency, took a sharper tone. At a time when authorities were still searching for the assassin's motive, Lake called the politics a fight between good and evil and attributed the killing to a horrific brainwashing campaign, while the suspected assassin, identified as 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, was in college. "I'm making a plea to mothers out there. Do not send your children into these indoctrination camps," Lake said. Kirk's assassination at an outdoor event at Utah Valley University sent shockwaves across the United States. By the age of 31, Kirk had become part of President Donald Trump's inner circle and power broker within the Make America Great Again movement. He built his organization, the Arizona-based Turning Point USA, into a political behemoth that raised and spent millions for GOP causes and candidates every year. Top Trump administration officials attended the vigil, including Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. U.S. Representatives Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona, delivered remarks praising Kirk's tenacity and wisdom. Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman, a top Turning Point ally who emceed the event, said more than 85 members of Congress were in attendance. "Some of the most powerful people on planet Earth are in this room tonight," Hoffman said, "all because Charlie had an indelible impact on their lives." As the sun set over the nation's capital, thousands packed into the historic Performing Arts Center, over which Trump has asserted control since he was re-elected president. The crowd stood, some singing along and raising their hands, as a musical trio kicked off the ceremony. The group sang Christian religious hymns accompanied by a wailing violin, cello, and acoustic guitar. The crowd bowed their heads in a prayer as Johnson praised Kirk as a good and faithful servant. They applauded as Leavitt told the crowd, "We cannot allow evil to prevail in our beautiful country." Several reflected on how Kirk, a prolific fundraiser and organizer for the GOP, helped their political campaigns. U.S. Representative Ana Paulina Luna, Republican of Florida, said Kirk helped her secure speaking slots on national television. Leavitt said Kirk supported her 2022 campaign for Congress. "Charlie personally and his team would check in with me throughout the campaign. They asked how they could help," Leavitt said. "When Washington super PACs poured money into the coffers of my opponents' campaigns, Charlie and Turning Point gave more to me to help me across the finish line. During Kirk's lifetime, Turning Point was a controversial force, even within the GOP. The group accomplished a dazzling political ascent, largely by purging their rivals within the party. Still, the sober ceremony emphasized unity over the factional controversies that Kirk generated. Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's director of national intelligence, invoked the words of civil rights activist Martin Luther King Jr., a person Kirk had argued was awful and not a good person. "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that," Gabbard said. Though most speakers focused on Kirk's life and legacy, some took a more overtly political tone, calling for vengeance against those seen as responsible for his assassination. Their remarks echoed Trump, who has vowed vengeance against the radical left for Kirk's killing. Lake shared some memories of Kirk, recounting advice he gave her on the campaign trail and fondly recalling a dinner they shared. Later, she riled up the crowd, asking how many of them had been canceled, been lawfared, or lost friends over their political views. She reminded the audience that Tyler Bauer, Kirk's right-hand man, whom several speakers thanked during their remarks, is being prosecuted as one of Arizona's fake electors. "They're trying to put him in prison, by the way," Lake said. She urged a no-holds-barred approach to politics. "I wish we could compromise, but you can't compromise with evil." Biggs, who is running for Arizona governor, called for mourning and grieving for a short season. The congressman has asked House leaders to form a committee to investigate money and influence networks on the American left. "It's incumbent upon us to save this nation and in turn save the world. This week, we were reminded how real evil is," Biggs said, "and it occurs in a vacuum when we forget God." By the time he died, Kirk had amassed an audience of millions across social media channels and his widely popular conservative talk show. The event attracted mourners from across the D.C. area. James Hughes is a senior studying communications at Virginia Tech, where Kirk was scheduled to visit in late September. When the conservative icon was shot dead, Hughes was left shaken and in tears. "I'll never forget it," Hughes, 22 years old, said as he stood outside the Kennedy Center to attend Kirk's vigil. "When I saw the video of what happened, I literally started crying. It just really hit me hard that this actually could happen in this country." Hughes, a Republican, said he had already feared that political violence would flare up before Kirk's killing. "It was getting to a very dangerous point, but this really just put me over the edge," he said. Christine Carmody, 65 years old, came to Charlie Kirk's vigil from her home in Frederick County, Maryland, to pay her respects to a wonderful, wonderful man. "It's just very sad for our country," said Carmody, a retired accountant. "He was a wonderful person, just preaching what he truly believed." Carmody said she hoped that Kirk's death would be a turning point, like the name of his foundation, Turning Point USA. While she didn't closely follow his campus tours, the issues he spoke about aligned with Carmody's conservative beliefs. "I also truly believe that President Trump wouldn't be in office right now if it wasn't for what Charlie Kirk did," she said. The next article is entitled, "Doctors Prescribe Food as Medicine," written by Clara Magoya. A farmer cooperative based in McNeil, a small town in Arizona's southeast corner, is ramping up local food access, along with a pilot program with the Benson Hospital that takes a food is medicine approach. The local co-op, a grower-operated food hub and grocery store, will work with the hospital to enroll 20 people with diet-related ailments and provide them with a weekly supply of locally grown produce for 90 days. The hospital will monitor key health data from the patients, such as blood pressure, sugar levels, and body mass index for analysis. The University of Arizona Cooperative Extension will provide nutritional education on site. The program is a vision of local co-op founder John Benedict, who self-funded a similar pilot program for 8 participants in March with a registered dietitian and a physical therapist, dedicating nearly $5,000 over time in crops, wages, and operating expenses. The larger goal is the Cochise Produce RX plan. Produce prescription is a healthcare approach that prescribes fruits and vegetables to patients with certain health conditions. A nutritious diet is good for anyone, but food also plays an important role in preventing illness and can even reverse some chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. Other medical conditions that benefit from nutritional therapy are heart disease, strokes, osteoporosis, and kidney disease, according to the Association of Nutrition and Food Service Professionals. The model has existed for a long time. 6 states already explicitly include produce prescription, or PRX, in their Medicaid programs. In Arizona, there are other pilot programs and ongoing research, but there is no policy in place. If someone goes to a doctor with a diet-related ailment, the doctor could prescribe a diet with certain foods, just like they would prescribe pills, Benedict explained. The patient can then take that referral from the doctor and use vouchers at a local store to fill the order. The seller would get reimbursed through Medicaid or AHCCS, Arizona's Medicaid. The co-op, the farmers, would be the new food pharmacists, Benedict joked. He hopes the results from this pilot can lead to partnerships with Sierra Vista Hospital or rural clinics in El Frida and eventually become accessible across the country. I see every day how much of our well-being comes down to what we eat and how we incorporate movement into our lives, said Veronica Jolivet, who administered the first in-house pilot and provided online marketing. She is excited that nurturing program is now moving to Benson Hospital to include more people. Benedict has struggled before he grew and sold organic produce at farmers markets, founded the local co-op in 2023, launched a mobile market initiative, and pitched PRX programs to local hospitals. Before securing a cheap piece of land in South Cochise County, which would later become the start of his organic farm, Desert Sky Produce, he was down to $500 and had been living in a tent and a van for nearly 2 years, he said, reselling products out of a warehouse lot and barely eking out a living. Escaping city life back east, he drove west until he got to Wilcox and later McNeil. It was the first time I ever had to humble myself and go to a food bank, Benedict recalls. At the food bank, he met people who would become his friends, mentors, and eventually customers. In a whirlwind of life-changing events, he learned to farm, began growing food, organized growers to open a retail space, and began serving the community with a variety of food-related programs. Paid through a food purchasing agreement program, which ends next year, he created a community-supported agriculture model for a local rehab center in the spring of 2023. The surplus of that grant became the seed to begin a CSA program for residents across the county, run from the local co-op retail store and pickup locations. Eventually, in October 2023, the local co-op got a grant to sell local produce to food banks. In like 4 years, I went from being a guy in line getting served at that food bank to then the guy farming for those same food banks, which was like really, really crazy, Benedict said. By 2024, the co-op had gained traction. Members invested in the building, brought new farmers and ranchers in, and started working with more partners across the county. Then came the Cochise Mobile Market, a retrofitted van the co-op purchased in January to bring hyper-local produce directly to each community, said Jillian Werowatz, operations manager at the co-op and owner of Lika's Veggies. With it, they connect residents with the farmers who grow and harvest nutrient-dense food just minutes away. The van takes fresh produce when it is not available close by and is growing its list of shops, including the Benson Hospital. Food access has always been the bread and butter for the co-op because, like personally, I saw what those food banks did for me, Benedict said. Not only the food, but, you know, that sense of community, meeting people, having a routine every week, things that keep you honest. While many sources of funding have been cut for small producers and food hubs, he sees promise in programs that will keep running regardless of federal dollars or are supported by the local co-op, like produce prescription programs, the mobile market, and a growing farm-to-school program across Cochise County. Today, the co-op is serving 7 school districts and will add 2 more by the end of the month, he said. The districts have pledged to dedicate 10% of their food procurement budget to local foods, even if there isn't reimbursement from the federally funded program. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a new grant program of $18 million on September 10th. Benedict hopes more people will get behind produce prescription, an investment in long-term community health that aligns with calls to make America healthy again and can also support agricultural economies. I self-funded it because I couldn't get anybody to give me a nickel anyway, he said. I would have loved to have more funding and this not be so difficult and have a bigger impact. Produce prescription programs increase access to nutritious food for people who are food insecure and have been applied in different ways across the United States. Although Arizona has no established PRX program through Medicaid, many health programs follow a food is medicine approach or have tried produce prescription pilot programs. Indian Health Services awarded $500,000 each to several tribes or tribal organizations across the country in 2023 so they could implement produce prescription programs in their communities. These included the Pascua Yaqui Tribe and the Navajo Health Foundation. In Douglas, dozens of participants receive custom produce boxes from the local co-op after the Arizona Community Health Workers Association applied last year to the Gus Schumacher Nutrition Incentive Program. At the University of Arizona, Melanie Hingle, a nutrition scientist and public health researcher, has been leading a grant research program from the National Institutes of Health to analyze the impact of a medically tailored grocery program in the Tucson community. This model provides groceries on top of produce, including items like cooking oil, grains, tuna, and spices. Working with El Rio Community Health Center, the research team enrolled 60 patients and designed prescription food boxes to treat diabetes. The produce was delivered weekly for 6 months and was sourced by Pivot Produce, a Tucson nonprofit that buys produce from member farmers from the local co-op as well. Friday, September 19th, is the last food box pickup. The impact on diabetes and on healthcare utilization, people's personal finance, and their perceived quality of health and life, that's all going to be analyzed in the next month or two, Hingle said. There's ample evidence that produce prescriptions can alleviate food insecurity and improve diet quality, but the impact on health outcomes is less clear because the programs and the way they are measured vary across the country, she added. Comparability is a challenge, Hingle explained. Comparing, for example, the different outcomes for people participating or not participating in the program isn't practical or ethical. They don't want to withhold potential care. We always ensure that people who are interested in participating in these food is medicine programs receive food, no matter what, she added. In this research and care program, they tackled that challenge by creating a wait list so some people didn't start right away but eventually received the program. Hingle believes there are other metrics researchers could use to evaluate all kinds of programs. Electronic health records can hint at whether patients are changing their interaction with the health system, how often they fill prescriptions, and if they have fewer emergency room visits and more preventative care visits. It's a view that could be looked at across all kinds of program types, she said, because those data are very consistent on the back end. Arizona Healthcare Care Cost Containment System, the state's Medicaid agency, doesn't cover produce prescriptions yet. Coverage tailored to the state's need can also be modified every 5 years through changes to Section 1115 waivers. Benedict advocated that food system workers and nonprofits to include produce prescriptions in this year's waiver revision, but couldn't find anyone to get behind the effort, he said. The state agency recently concluded a series of public listening sessions to gather feedback on both existing programs and potential future initiatives that may be included in the renewal request, a spokesperson said. They couldn't confirm if any provider asked for PRX or medically tailored grocery programs. It's still early in the process, the spokesperson said, and no final decisions have been made regarding which programs will be included. The next article is entitled, Press Groups Win in LAPD and DHS Lawsuits, written by Brianna Frank. A federal judge handed press and civil liberties groups wins in two separate cases against the Los Angeles Police Department and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem over the treatment of journalists covering immigration raid protests. U.S. District Judge Hernan Vera's preliminary injunctions bar, among other actions, the police department from arresting journalists for failing to disperse or otherwise interfering with journalists' ability to cover Los Angeles protests. The Department of Homeland Security's officers are also barred from dispersing, threatening, or assaulting journalists who haven't committed a crime unrelated to failing to obey a dispersal order. In his September 10th order in the Los Angeles Police Department case, Vera wrote the department's heavy-handed efforts to police this summer's protests violated both state and federal law. In granting the motion in the DHS case, Vera said federal officers unleashed crowd control weapons indiscriminately and with surprising savagery during the protests. Specifically, the court concludes that federal agents' indiscriminate use of force will undoubtedly chill the media's efforts to cover these public events and protesters seeking to express peacefully their views on national policies, Vera wrote. He went on to condemn individuals who engaged in violent action during such protests, but said, "The actions of a relative few does not give DHS carte blanche to unleash near-lethal force on crowds of third parties in the vicinity." In taking such actions, Vera wrote, federal officers have endangered peaceful protesters, journalists, and the broader public. USA Today reached out to the police department and the Department of Homeland Security for comment. There's an old line in policing, they can do this the easy way or they can do it the hard way, Adam Rose, press rights chair of the Los Angeles Press Club, said in a news release following the rulings. Press organizations have been trying to help LAPD for years take the easy way, just asking them to train officers and discipline offenders. They wouldn't stop resisting. LAPD failed to police themselves. Now a judge is doing it for them. The First Amendment Coalition filed the federal lawsuit against the police department in U.S. District Court for the Central District of California on behalf of the Press Club and the independent media outlet Status Quo in mid-June. Days later, a similar lawsuit was filed against NOM over what the plaintiffs, including the Los Angeles Press Club and the News Guild Communications Workers of America, described as federal officers' unconstitutional actions against journalists. Vera issued a temporary restraining order in the Los Angeles Police Department case on July 10th that barred officers from using powerful crowd control weapons against journalists not posing a threat to law enforcement. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, What Faith Leaders Had to Say on Kirk's Death, written by Jose Gonzalez, Stephanie Murray, and Ray Covarrubias. The fatal shooting of conservative activist and Valley resident Charlie Kirk was acknowledged by faith leaders and religious institutions across the Metro Phoenix area. Kirk, 31 years old, was killed September 10th after a rooftop shooter opened fire during a stop on the activist's American Comeback Tour at Utah Valley University in Orem, Utah. Authorities identified the suspect as Tyler Robinson, 22 years old, of Utah, who is now in custody. On September 11th, Kirk's body was flown back to Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport aboard Air Force Two, accompanied by U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. "I know that right now there are a lot of different emotions in this room. There's everything from sadness to anger to despair," said Jason Stinson, a pastor at Redeemer Bible Church in Gilbert, during a 10:30 a.m. service September 14th. A sermon delivered by Pastor Virgil Walker at times infused a conservative viewpoint with a biblical perspective. "Before we open the Word of God, we want to pause and acknowledge the grief that many are carrying as you witness what has happened over the past week, whether it be what happened to Charlie Kirk or Inra Zaruska," Walker said. "The gospel will never be silenced by violence." At Central Christian Church in Gilbert, John Moten, pastor, called for a moment of silence during Sunday services to pray for our country. "Our country needs Jesus," said Cal Jernigan, a retired pastor from the church, who also spoke. Jernigan described a heaviness that infiltrated the lives of the churchgoers after Kirk's death. "The more and more we move away from Jesus, the worse it gets. I believe with all my heart this is going to be a wake-up call in America," said Jernigan. "We pray for an outpouring of the presence of God in the hearts and the lives of the families who have been affected by everything this week," said Des Wadsworth, lead pastor at Grace Community Church in Tempe, at its 9 a.m. service September 14th. "It starts with your heart," Wadsworth said, referring to Kirk as Brother Charlie. Rasmussen called for unity among the youth, which Kirk resonated with. Dream City Church mentioned Kirk in its usual Sunday services. The church partnered with Kirk in his effort to elect President Donald Trump in 2024. Pastor Luke Barnett said Kirk lived a short life, but that his impact was massive during a pair of services that blended faith and politics and drew thousands of people. The church displayed a black and white photo of Kirk against an American flag background with the message, "Well done, Charlie." Charlie did not die for his political views. He died for his biblical views, Barnett said. He went on the campuses knowing that there was a real danger. He received death threats all the time, and yet he was still on all these campuses. He proclaimed the gospel of Jesus Christ and the values of Jesus Christ. And by the way, he was doing the very things that pastors across America should be doing. The church showed a video where Kirk said before he was killed that he would like to be remembered for having courage for my faith. The pastor also played audio of an artificial intelligence rendering of what Kirk might say if he were still alive. Shan Trudeau, a 14-year-old who lives in Glendale, helped place the American flags that blanketed the front lawn of the church in Kirk's honor on September 14th. "He did a lot of great things for our country," Trudeau said. "Kirk's death has rocked the Dream City Church community," he said. "It was very shocking, not just for me, but for my family, the church, and the country," Trudeau said. Peoria resident Brandon Berry, 39 years old, said he felt called to visit Dream City Church and honor Kirk. "I just felt like God put on my heart to just come and pay my respects," Berry said. Rabbi Pinchas Alush of Congregation Beth Tefala in Scottsdale told the Arizona Republic in an email that he valued the Turning Point USA founders' ability to create respectful dialogues between those with varying political views. During my sermon this past Shabbat at Congregation Beth Tephala, I spoke about my friend Charlie Kirk. I shared that regardless of whether one agreed or disagreed with him, the dehumanization we see in society must stop immediately, Alush said. The rabbi reflected on the lesson he believed could be taught by understanding history, especially toward Jewish people. This is precisely what the Nazis did. Hitler compared Jews to mosquitoes, which made it easier to justify their murder. What we witnessed this past week is a tragic product of the same corrosive mindset that strips away the dignity of those with whom we disagree, Alush said. Alush saw Kirk as a figure who stood up for faith and communications. Charlie's only goal was to engage in dialogue with respect. He gave the microphone to those who opposed him and always spoke with dignity, recognizing the image of God in every human being, Alush said. He described Kirk as a man of goodness through and through. He also shared a tribute to Kirk on Facebook. First and foremost, we commend the soul of Charlie Kirk to the mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ. May he welcome Charlie into eternal life, grant peace to his grieving family, and bring healing to all who loved him, said Christopher Perea, CEO of Trapeic Leadership Incorporated, which is a leadership program for the development of Catholic professionals. Charlie leaves behind a wife, children, colleagues, and countless young people he inspired. We unite ourselves in their sorrow, and we ask God to give them fortitude and consolation in this hour of grief. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix Bishop John Dolan released a statement condemning political violence, addressing Kirk's slaying and the June 14th shooting death of Democratic Minnesota House Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman. Such acts defy our nation's commitment to free speech and democratic participation, read Dolan's September 11th statement. This violence violates an even deeper law, the law of peace and love. Political disagreement must never descend into bloodshed. In a September 11th Facebook post, Peoria's non-denominational Christ Church of the Valley pastor Ashley Wooldridge shared biblical scripture as he observed the taking of Kirk's life and the 24th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Paul was writing at a time of similar cultural upheaval and division, not unlike the present. And yet I will show you the most excellent way, read a captioned image. Woolridge's message mentioned Paul the Apostle's exalting in the principles of faith, hope, and love. The hope of our world is not politics, not control, not even safety, Woolridge's post read. The hope of the world is Jesus. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on broadcast info and audio, and then on demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Israel Defends Striking Hamas in Qatar, written by Andrew Mills, Janice Shakur, Simon Lewis, and Stephen Shear. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he didn't rule out further strikes on Hamas leaders, wherever they are, as the heads of Arab and Islamic states held a summit to show support for Qatar after Israel's attack on the Gulf state on September 9th. The strike targeting leaders of the Palestinian militant group in Doha marked a significant escalation of Israeli military action in a region shaken by conflict since the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attacks that ignited the conflict. The emergency Arab-Islamic summit hosted by Doha was expected to warn that the Israeli attack and other hostile acts by Israel threaten coexistence and efforts to normalize ties in the region, according to a draft resolution seen by Reuters. Addressing the summit, Qatar Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani said the Israeli attack was cowardly and treacherous, saying Hamas leaders had been studying a U.S. ceasefire proposal presented to them by Qatar and Egypt when it took place. Hamas says the Israeli attack killed five of its members, but not its leadership. A member of Qatar's internal security forces was also killed. Targeting close U.S. ally Qatar, the Israeli strike has prompted U.S. allied Gulf Arab nations to close ranks, notably adding to strains in ties between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, which were normalized in 2020. Speaking alongside Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Jerusalem, Netanyahu said Israel was still getting final reports on the results of the strike. Rubio will travel to Qatar after his visit to Israel, a senior U.S. State Department official said. Rubio called on Qatar to continue to play a constructive role in resolving the Gaza conflict, saying it could help reach the goals of releasing all 48 hostages still held in Gaza, disarming Hamas, and building a better future for Gazans. And so we're going to continue to encourage Qatar to play a constructive role in that regard, he said. President Donald Trump has indicated displeasure with the attack and said on September 14th, Israel should be careful. My message is that they have to be very, very careful. They have to do something about Hamas, but Qatar has been a great ally to the United States, he said. An excerpt of the draft resolution seen by Reuters said the brutal Israeli attack on Qatar and the continuation of Israel's hostile acts, including genocide, ethnic cleansing, starvation, siege, and colonizing activities and expansion policies, threatens prospects of peace and coexistence in the region. These actions threaten everything that has been achieved on the path of normalizing ties with Israel, including current agreements and future ones, according to the draft, which was drawn up by foreign ministers meeting ahead of the summit. Israel has been widely accused of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, including by the world's biggest group of genocide scholars, during its nearly two-year campaign in the Palestinian enclave that has killed more than 64,000 people, according to local authorities. Qatar has acted as a key mediator in the Gaza conflict and has accused Israel of sabotaging chances for peace and Netanyahu of practicing state terrorism. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani said on September 14th that Israel's actions would not stop Doha's mediation efforts with Egypt and the United States. While diplomacy was unfolding in Jerusalem and Doha, Israeli forces were continuing their assault on Gaza City, where they killed at least 16 Palestinians in strikes on two homes and on a tent housing a displaced family, local health authorities said. The army also hit and destroyed a 16-floor building in the west of the city, believed to be the tallest in the Gaza Strip, about an hour after warning displaced families sheltering inside and nearby to leave. It said the building was being used to hide terrorist infrastructure. Rubio gave strong backing to Israel, which has grown increasingly isolated on the world stage because of the widespread indignation at the enormous death toll in Gaza and the ongoing humanitarian and hunger crisis in the Palestinian enclave. The top UN expert on Palestinian rights, Francesco Albanese, said Israel was trying to make Gaza City unlivable in its assault on the enclave's largest urban area and was endangering the lives of Israeli hostages. Israel is bombing using unconventional weapons. It is trying to forcibly evacuate Palestinians. Why? This is the last piece of Gaza that needs to be rendered unlivable before advancing the ethnic cleansing of that piece of land, Albanese told reporters in Geneva. The permanent mission of Israel to the UN rejected Albanese's comments. Her numerous statements have showcased her willingness to go to extreme lengths in the delegitimization of the State of Israel, the mission said in a statement. According to her, Hamas doesn't embed itself in civilian infrastructure, doesn't cynically use civilians as human shields, and generally doesn't really exist, it added. Israel says the offensive to take control of Gaza City is part of a plan to defeat Hamas for good, and that it has warned civilians to head south to a designated humanitarian zone. However, the United Nations and numerous countries say its tactics amount to forced mass displacement and that conditions in the humanitarian zone are dire, with food in short supply. The next article is entitled, Trump's Approval Rating Above Water in 25 States, written by Kinsey Crowley. President Donald Trump received a positive approval rating in 25 states, according to Morning Consult, which gathers polls over the course of 3 months to get a look at state-level data among registered voters. The September update has two fewer states with net positive approval ratings than the same firm's report in August. North Carolina and Nevada are the two states that have flipped to give Trump a net negative approval rating since August's update. Georgia is the only 2024 swing state where he has a positive approval rating, according to Morning Consult, which also finds it breaks even in Arizona. Trump announced September 12th he would send the National Guard to Memphis, Tennessee, next in his crime crackdown. Trump said Tennessee Governor Bill Lee welcomed the help. "The mayor is happy, the governor is happy," Trump said on Fox News' Fox and Friends. "Deeply troubled, we're going to fix that just like we did Washington." Trump deployed the National Guard in the District of Columbia in early August, saying it was necessary to tamp down crime, even though crime was already down this year. He has the authority to deploy the Guard in the nation's capital, but governors usually oversee deployment in states. The president weighed sending troops to Chicago. However, he stopped short as Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker strongly opposed the idea of deployment. In Illinois, 41% of governors approve of Trump's job performance, and 55% of voters disapprove, his 11th worst state, Morning Consult found in its September 5th report. In Tennessee, where Trump says he will deploy the National Guard next, 58% of voters approve of his job performance, compared with 38 who disapprove, his 6th best rating among the states, according to Morning Consult. Morning Consult's overall approval rating for Trump from surveys of 2,201 registered U.S. voters from September 6th to 8th found 45% of voters approve of Trump's job performance, compared with 52% who disapprove. Real Clear Politics poll average shows Trump's approval rating was becoming more negative throughout the first few weeks of July before buoying toward the end of the month and staying fairly steady over the last month. Aggregated polls by the New York Times show a similar trend. As of January 27th, Trump received a plus 6.2 percentage point approval rating. But as of March 13th, it flipped to slightly negative, the Real Clear Politics graphics show. The approval rating reached its most negative on April 29th at minus 7.2 percentage points, which fell around Trump's 100-day mark. He came close to that low again on July 22nd and 23rd, at minus 7.1 percentage points, as the controversy over Jeffrey Epstein continued into its third week. His average approval rating margin as of September 12th, according to Real Clear Politics, is minus 5.5 percentage points. The approval margin, according to the New York Times aggregator on September 12th, is minus 8 percentage points. In a Gallup poll conducted from August 1st to August 20th, 40% approved of Trump's job performance. The next article is entitled, U.S. Strikes Again, Killing Three, written by Idris Ali and Phil Stewart. President Donald Trump said on September 15th, that the U.S. military carried out a strike on an alleged Venezuelan drug cartel vessel headed to the United States, the second such strike carried out against a suspected drug boat in recent weeks. He said three men were killed in the strike, adding that it occurred in international waters. Trump provided no evidence for his assertion that the boat was carrying drugs. This morning, on my orders, U.S. military forces conducted a second kinetic strike against positively identified, extraordinarily violent drug trafficking cartels and narco-terrorists in the Southcom area of responsibility, Trump said in a post on Truth Social. These extremely violent drug trafficking cartels pose a threat to U.S. national security, foreign policy, and vital U.S. interests, Trump said. U.S. Southern Command, Southcom, is the military's combatant command that encompasses 31 countries through South and Central America and the Caribbean. The post also included a nearly 30-second video with markings of unclassified on the top, which appeared to show a vessel in a body of water exploding and then on fire. Later on September 15th, Trump said, "We have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was splattered all over the ocean, large bags of cocaine and fentanyl." Reuters conducted initial checks on the video with an AI detection tool, but the video was partly blurred, making it impossible to confirm if the video was manipulated. However, thorough verification is an ongoing process, and Reuters will continue to review the footage as more information becomes available. The Venezuelan Communications Ministry did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The latest strike comes amid a large U.S. military buildup in the Southern Caribbean. 5 U.S. F-35 aircraft were seen landing in Puerto Rico on September 13th after the Trump administration ordered 10 of the stealth fighters to join the buildup. There are at least 7 U.S. warships in the region, along with 1 nuclear-powered submarine. Trump, speaking with reporters on September 15th, suggested operations could be carried out on land against suspected drug smugglers. "When they come by land, we're going to be stopping them the same way we stopped the boats," Trump said. "But maybe by talking about it a little bit, it won't happen." Earlier this month, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told sailors and Marines on a warship off Puerto Rico that they were not deployed to the Caribbean for training, but instead sent to be the front lines of a critical counter-narcotics mission. On September 15th, Hegseth, in a post on X, suggested an expansive mission for the U.S. military against drug traffickers. "We'll track them, kill them, and dismantle their networks throughout our hemisphere at the times and places of our choosing." Trump has ordered the Department of Defense to rename itself the Department of War, a change that will require action by Congress. The new name would apply to Hegseth as well, altering his title to Secretary of War. Hours before Trump's post, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said that recent incidents between his country and the United States were an aggression by the United States, and that communications between the two governments had largely ended. The Trump administration has provided scant information about the first strike on September 2nd, despite demands from U.S. lawmakers that the government justify the action. It is alleged those on board were members of a Venezuelan gang, Tren de Aragua, and said 11 people were killed. The Pentagon has not publicly said what type of drugs that boat was carrying, or how much, or even what type of weapons were used to carry out the strike. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.